what is the approach going to be to communicating the value assessments regarding products, i.e. A description of how this product delivers fair value, which is what the Consumer Duty asks for. Hello and welcome to Grant Thornton's Risk and Regulation Unraveled podcast, where we take a look at the month's developments in the world of financial services regulation. My name is David Moy and I'm joined as always by my colleague Ben Farmer. Say hello, Ben.
Hello, everyone.
I'm disappointed that the budget this month did not extend to a bit of musical accompaniment, because I was thinking of the opening fanfare of 2001 AD, also Sprach Zarathustra. A grand fanfare to celebrate the arrival in the live environment of the Consumer Duty, or at least that part of the Consumer Duty that went live at the end of April. If that's not deserving of a fanfare, I can't think what is. And I thought we would just check in actually to see what's going on with that first deadline. For those who don't recall what that is instantly, it was the requirement that manufacturers communicate to their distributors information regarding customer profiles, target customer profiles, and also value assessments in order to inform the distributors' approach to distributing those products. So Ben, I mean, we kind of both work across somewhat different sectors in terms of day-to-day focus areas. I'm curious what you've been seeing in relation to the level and quality of information that's being produced.
I think it's probably fair to say that in general terms, most of what we're saying has been left to the last minute. I think in particular, perhaps coming back to the quality of the information itself, in terms of the actual means of distributing the information, it's not necessarily been especially comprehensive. There's a lot of suggestion that certain manufacturers have basically just popped things on a page on their website and left it up to distributors to go looking for it themselves, rather than doing much in the way of proactive contact. I know in the insurance sector in particular, most of the brokers I've been speaking to over the last few weeks have been saying they've had very little, if any, sort of contact from their manufacturers in the run-up to this. So if there's been any activity at all, it seems safe to say much of it will have been in a sort of exactly the kind of last minute rush that this April deadline was really put in place to avoid. So a good own goal from the industry there, as usual. I know some of the manufacturers we've spoken to, also within insurance, there were pre-existing Prod 4 rules requiring a lot of this information. So some manufacturers basically suggesting, well, we don't need to do anything for the April deadline because we already did it, which seems like quite a punchy stance to take on something this high profile. A few others going down more of a middle road route of basically just reissuing what they'd already produced under Prod 4. Just a sort of useful reminder to brokers that this is out there and this is what you need to meet your Consumer Duty requirements.
Yes, I'd echo a lot of that. Obviously, as you see, you had the Prod 4 rules in much of the investment management sector, the Prod 3 rules. So and I think more generally, target market, i.e. who this product is appropriate for, is probably something that seems to be communicated reasonably well, albeit in different formats, in different sectors, different templates in use. I think one of the things that's been most interesting for me was always going to be the most interesting for me was, what is the approach going to be to communicating the value assessments regarding products, i.e. A description of how this product delivers fair value, which is what the Consumer Duty asks for. Now, overwhelmingly, pretty much across all sectors, I think what we've seen is a pretty boilerplate statement that says, we, the manufacturer, have followed a robust process to assess value, and it provides it, full stop. That's about it, largely. I've encountered a very, very small number of manufacturers who've, for instance, color-coded, done red, amber, green, so actually given a sense of, it's good value, we've got some concerns in the amber box, or even red. Actually, I've not heard anyone that's actually red graded anything, but at least conceptually they're allowing for a sort of a variety of outcomes as opposed to just a blanket positive assessment. Beyond that, no real data or substance in most cases to support that assessment, at least not shared with distributors, and that's probably perhaps understandable given the potential commercial sensitivity, but it's I think for me that's an area that I think it is always likely to lead to the FCA providing supervisory feedback and seeking to raise the bar on the quality of those assessments and the quality of information disclosed, because I mean, essentially, your average distributor's probably got, let's say they have 50 manufacturers they use. I mean, probably a random number there, but they've probably got essentially 50 almost identical statements that they can do nothing with, essentially, because they're all the same.
Yeah, they don't give them a way to differentiate, choose the greater or lesser value products, do they?
Yeah. So I mean, but I guess for the most part, firms did get over the line, as you say, at the very, very last minute. I think time will tell whether the FCA thinks it's really meaningful level of disclosure. Time obviously also will tell, you know, whether distributors, you know, act on that information. Okay, you know, we're assuming that the information is has enough substance for them to act on.
I'll tell you one thing. It occurs to me I've seen no examples of. I don't know if you've seen any. Is any manufacturers who have actually, if you're not saying, actually, we've done a fair value assessment and we've concluded we're not happy with the value this product offers, and can you perhaps hold fire on selling it until we fix that?
I've not heard that explicitly. I wouldn't surprise me. So even in the run into this, so we are starting to see, and I think this is important, and I think the FCA will certainly leap on some examples. I know there's some confidential stuff I probably can't share on podcast, but I think we are beginning to see examples where manufacturers in particular are pulling products, not sort of undermining their entire business model in doing so, but you know, looking at particular products and saying, actually, this is no longer, it doesn't meet the standards we would expect for the Consumer Duty. For instance, it's being bought, most of the people who are buying this product are actually not of an age demographic, for instance, where they would benefit from it. Or, you know, in certain cases, if I say an annuity product, they, you know, they're not, then we don't think they're healthy enough to live long enough to benefit from this product. But I think there are going to be some an increasing number of examples actually where actually change has happened, and I would expect actually that the FCA would probably consider that encouraging enough to think that more can be achieved in the long run.
Yes, no, I suppose that's why it's not feeding through then, isn't it? I guess because it sounds like firms are potentially basically pulling the products before the first fair value assessment has been due. So there hasn't been a piece of paperwork to share at the end of it, at least not publicly facing. I'm sure there'll be something internal should the regulator turn up and ask for it.
Yes. Okay. So, yes, obviously the April deadline was just an interim deadline, just an information sharing deadline. The big deadline is at the end of July. And obviously we'll be talking at that point more about how firms feel they have accomplished the challenges of the Consumer Duty and what still remains to be done. I thought we'd leave with the Consumer Duty, but there are some other things going on in the world. I know it's hard to believe if you're working on a Consumer Duty project, it may be hard to believe there's other things going on in the world. But other things we picked up on, well, there was one I was looking at, the FCA provided some feedback on LDI, so liability-driven investment. This is looking at the root causes from a risk management point of view of the issues LDI-driven pension funds, pension assets had in and around the changing gilt prices with the Liz Truss administration, somewhat short-lived administration. It sought to ask, sort to come up with some suggestions. So this is a guidance document on how investment managers should be seeking to make their risk frameworks around LDI more effective, so less likely to fall over, to cause significant stresses to their client pension schemes in the event of something similar. And there's a lot of just reiterating sort of standard risk framework, you know, having liquidity cushions, etc. So it's not writing any new rules, it's repeating kind of sound principles. But there were a couple of things that made me sit up a little bit. One was that in managing liquidity within the LDI fund that you are running. So as an investment manager, I'm running an LDI fund on behalf of a client, and considering what level of liquidity resilience I should have in that fund, what kind of cushion I should be carrying to deal with the liquidity stress. I should bear in mind the other sources of liquidity that would be available to that client, i.e. on pools of assets or other sources of liquidity that you don't manage, that actually aren't in your control or responsibility, but essentially you should be aware of the wider situation of your clients sufficient to be able to to manage liquidity on that one fund you actually do control, but taking into account other sources of liquidity, which is, you know, I think an extension of the understanding of liquidity risk that is probably inherent or has been inherent up to this point. But the other piece of feedback which I thought was interesting and actually highly relevant, it was in relation to the operational processes around managing clients during stress, clients' investments during stress, and the conflicts of interest inherent in that operational process. The point they were making, which is very relevant, is you may have multiple clients that are all being impacted by the same stress. You almost certainly would have multiple clients impacted by the same stress, all of them needing potentially to sell assets in order to meet a liquidity need, which is the circumstance here. And actually, the order with which you did it, which clients you did first, would have an impact on the outcomes of those clients, i.e., as is usually the case, the client you act for first is probably going to do better than the client who's 10 places down the list in terms of outcomes. And you know, having some kind of framework to manage that, the potential conflict between clients, particularly where there's a communication step required. So, you know, who do you pick up the phone to first? It was quite, I think, quite a telling observation, because it was certainly a factor during the LDI stresses that, you know, the schemes that were having to liquidate assets later in the process were considerably worse off than those that had acted earlier. So yes, I thought there was some interesting stuff there in the feedback, and enough to get some investment managers thinking about their risk framework somewhat. That was LDI. Sorry if that's a bit geeky. I do enjoy that stuff. Ben, a bit more in your wheelhouse though. The FCA also we're talking about multi-occupancy leasehold insurance.
Yes. So if you were concerned that investment risk management was too geeky, don't worry. We're now going to talk about insurance product governance, which is, less geeky, perhaps, in some way. So we've got a consultation paper out with some draft rules. The issue, in short, that the FCA is trying to address here is that where leaseholders in blocks of flats, they have to buy buildings insurance via their property managing agents. But of course, it's the managing agent who's actually buying the policy, because it's a single policy covering the whole block, rather than the individual leaseholders buying. So leaseholders, as a result, find it very difficult to challenge and understand the costs being passed on to them. And there's been an ongoing level of concern for a number of years now that some of the commissions within this sector might be higher than is strictly reasonable and may not represent fair value. But that's all been massively compounded since the Grenfell Tower disaster, when the underlying risk price that these commissions are typically taken as a percentage of has increased hugely for a number of mid and high rise buildings.
Yes.
So that sort of compounded this, and there's been various angry letters sent. The FCA has sent some Dear CEO letters. The Secretary of State, Mr. Gove, has sent some letters. But because up till now, the leaseholders under the FCA rules have not technically been customers, and many of the property managing agents were not FCA authorised, The FCA has basically struggled to actually do terribly much about this issue. So they're now going down the route.
No, but there's a thing called consumer duty.
there absolutely is. But of course, the difficulty is that your leaseholders are still technically not your customers. The property managing agent is the customer. However, in some circumstances, despite being the customer, the property managing agent also receives commission, which is clearly not an ideal state of affairs in many ways. So this consultation paper has a number of potential proposals set out within it to try and address these. One of these is providing increased information to leaseholders, and that information is going to include commission disclosure across all parties in the chain. So both the commission received by and the commission paid to brokers and any commission paid to property managing agents. So the FCA's theory is that by giving this information to leaseholders, this then puts pressure on all parties to reduce commission levels. I'm personally not 100% convinced that's going to happen, because A, giving leaseholders more information doesn't fundamentally change the fact that they're not the ones doing the shopping.
Yeah.
And B, the FCA tried something similar in the retail insurance market a few years back with the renewal transparency rules, where they made insurers put last year's premium next to this year's premium in a renewal notice. Again, the idea was people would notice the price increases that were going on. They would ring their insurers up and negotiate a better price, and it sort of organically kills the pricing practice off without the need for a slightly firmer intervention. That didn't work. So a few years later, we did have the firmer intervention with the GI pricing rules. Mm. So I'm not convinced that'll work here. The one that I think is more likely to drive change, if anything's going to, is that the PROD rules, so the product governance rules for the fair value assessments we've been talking about on and off all podcast already, will be amended so that leaseholders will be made beneficiaries. Leaseholders already are beneficiaries of these products, and the rules will be amended so that for the purposes of the PROD rules, the definition of a customer will include beneficiaries. So this means that now, when insurance product manufacturers and distributors are doing their fair value assessment on multi-occupancy insurance, instead of assessing the value for the property managing agent, which they would have had to do before, they now have to assess the value received by the leaseholders.
Yes.
And obviously this, backed up by the consumer duty rules and the budget for enforcement of consumer duty and the fairly intense supervisory activity we already expect in this area, I think if anything's going to drive change here, it's going to be that.
Yes, I would agree exactly right. That feels very, very thematically in keeping with the consumer duty as well, to understand the impact on the end customer, as it were, even if they're not quite a customer. Excellent. Okay, so that you said that's consultation, so we'll have a few months presumably before final rules.
Yeah.
Okay. The last item I thought I'd pick up from the FCA specifically, we'll move on to the PRA in a moment, but the FCA did announce the redress scheme in relation to Woodford investors. So these are investors, 300,000 of them, I think, in the Woodford Equity Income Fund. So Neil Woodford obviously got into a spot of bother around the liquidity or lack thereof within that fund. And all of this time, obviously several years have passed, when those investors have not been compensated, despite the fact that the authorised fund manager responsible for the fund, an organisation called Link Financial Services, had been subject to enforcement action and a £50 million fine, in fact, for failing to oversight that fund correctly. All of which had happened without any kind of compensation being paid to anyone, a meaningful compensation. So the redress scheme has now been agreed between the FCA and Link, and it is an agreement, and it's also a scheme of arrangement, so it will require approval by the court. Well, therefore, there are numerous ways in which this could all fall over, and actually the FCA announcement makes it very clear that it could fall over. I mean, the headlines are the FCA thinks that there's about the absolute loss to customers is something like £300 million. The redress scheme doesn't go that far. It amounts to £235 million. That's made up of essentially all of Link Financial Services capital and all of its insurance cover. That gets you to about £100 million. And the remaining 135 are contingent on Link's UK business being sold. which could happen by October because there's a transaction in process there. So essentially this compensation is going to be made up of, you know, wiping out Link, hitting the PI insurers and the proceeds of the sale of the UK operations. So in other words, there's quite a few moving parts that could cause this to fall over, and thus this story will continue to rumble on. I think one of the things I found interesting is the FCA said in the announcement that the 50 million fine for Link they will waive if this scheme goes ahead. Essentially, you know, that's 50 million that can go to customers then rather than into HM Treasury's pocket. But if the scheme doesn't go ahead, then the 50 million fine's happening anyway. So we shall see what happens. But I think, you know, it was quite a lot of public interest in that, given the general feeling that this issue has been around for a long time and has still not led to customer redress being paid, and probably won't actually this side of the fourth quarter, even under this scheme.
I assume someone rather clever than me has already come up with an answer to this, but if all of Link's assets are being sold and all of Link's insurance cover is being used up, what, and then Link itself is being sold to fund it, what exactly are you buying if you buy Link now, and why is anyone going to do that?
No, what they're wiping out is the capital base of Link Financial. So the business, the operating assets, yeah, the contracts with clients, etc. But they're basically wiping out the assets on the balance sheet of the entity. Yeah. So
as usual, I don't have to go far to find that someone cleverer than me who's thought this through properly.
Yes. No, that's fine. Well, no, I haven't seen the detailed numbers. I'm just going on what the press release says, and that's my understanding. But we'll see how that plays out. I was going to segue from the FCA to the PRA, actually, because you know, about a month ago we were talking about the FCA business plan, and now we have the PRA business plan. And I thought I'd do a quick summary if you're interested, Ben.
Yes, please.
Obviously we all know the PRA went from being a sort of more or less semi-independent entity to just being a department within the Bank of England. And although it's called the PRA business plan, when you print it off at the top of every page, it just says Bank of England. So it is, you know, it's a department of the Bank of England. We're still calling it the PRA, but it's very much the Bank of England. The similarities to last year, so four strategic priorities, which are basically the safety and soundness of the banking and insurance sector, maintaining that, being at the forefront of new and emerging risks and developing international policies. So that's sort of being at the forefront of international regulatory development, supporting competitive and dynamic markets. So there's a nod there, and I'll talk in a second about it competitiveness objective or secondary objective. And then finally, a more internal facing one about running an inclusive, efficient and modern regulator. It's, as a document, it's a relatively simple read. Unlike the FCA document, the PRA business plan still organises itself mainly around the rules consultations, the regulatory initiatives, the changes they are going to be driving forward. So as we discussed with the FCA plan, most of that now sits in the regulatory initiatives grid, and the FCA business plan is more, these are the things that are important to us. These are these are the guiding principles that we're going to follow, rather than the kind of list, item by item list of activity. Well, the PRA plan is more of an item by item list, albeit in narrative form. Nothing dramatically new compared to what we would have seen in the regulatory initiatives grid. Things I picked up, they are talking about international competitiveness. That they very much signal that means a lot in their mind, aligning to international standards. So that doesn't mean deregulation, that just means aligning to international standards. But they do say that in any new initiative they develop, they will make an explicit analysis, judgment, description of how they believe it contributes to international competitiveness. So it will be a factor. It has a rundown of, you know, some of the things that they're working on. So obviously two changes, Basel 3.1 implementation, SMCR reforms, remuneration changes, ring fencing tweaks, etc. It identifies particular uptick in supervisory activity around claims inflation. So the impact on the financial standing of insurers because of, you know, cost of living inflation increases driving up the scale of insurance claims. See whether that's an issue. And also continued focus, actually, but expanded focus on trading book risk management. So this is, you know, things like Archegos blowing up, etc. And looking at how banks manage their trading book risk. And then there's the familiar things that the FCA were talking about, because they're joint exercises between the FCA and the PRA. So oversight of critical third parties, where rules are going to be forthcoming, working on the regime for crypto assets, working, you know, long term and at least on artificial intelligence, etc., and the regulatory regime there. And I suppose the last point I'd make is, the FCA, this was in the FCA business plan, it's in the PRA plan as well, you know, commitment to try and raise the standard of their cost benefit analysis work. So they're talking about appointing a cost benefit analysis panel. And developing a new cost benefit analysis framework, etc. So hopefully the CBAs under new rules development will become more robust, be done to a higher standard. I guess the final thing to say is that unlike the FCA, where there was a close to 10% budget increase, the PRA budget largely flat. Actually, went down slightly because pension costs were. We're down, because of investment changes. I think their contribution to the pension scheme was lower. But essentially headcount still around 1400. It's pretty flat picture there. So that was the PRA business plan. We also saw we haven't had too many enforcement related fines this month, but there was one from the PRA which got my attention. Ben, I'm guessing you spotted it as well.
Yes, this will presumably be the fine for the former Chief Information Officer of TSB,
which the senior managers regime was mentioned quite.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is the first individual senior manager fine we've seen raised by the PRA, isn't it? So
yes,
the Chief Info Officer who held the SMF 18 position, so that would have been the other overall responsibility. Senior manager function has been fined £116,000 by the PRA, although, as usual, that's been significantly discounted for agreeing to settle early over TSB's much publicised IT migration debacle. I think, frankly, either regulator could have raised this fine. In fact, I think when the firm was fined a few months ago, it was a joint final notice between both SCA and PRA. But it's the PRA acting on this one under Senior Manager Conduct Rule 2, which is that you must take reasonable steps to ensure that the business of the firm for which you are responsible complies with the relevant requirements and standards of the regulatory system. So basically, the gist here very much being that this senior manager was responsible for ensuring that the IT migration went smoothly. IT migration clearly did not go smoothly at all.
Obviously to land an enforcement action, you need to show, well, I'm not a lawyer, but essentially their actions would have been were unreasonable, you know, were outside of the normal range of behaviours you would have expected for someone in that role. What do you think that comes through in the notice?
Yes, I think it does. I think the particular focus was around the PRA clearly would have an expectation that this individual take reasonable steps to ensure effective management of the migration process, is their wording. So this is obviously around the senior managers having to assure themselves that whatever they're responsible for is being done appropriately. I think, as an example, one thing they point to in the final notice is that so much of this migration had been outsourced, and so as part of their own assurance, this senior manager had relied on a attestation letter from the outsourcer. And the PRA seemed to be of the view that those letters were not subject to sufficient kind of scrutiny or challenge. They were just accepted at face value. I think one of the letters in particular the PRA says was, to some extent, forward-looking statements of good intention or expectations rather than statements of fact about the completeness of readiness activities already undertaken. something that the clear letter there for, for senior managers being, don't settle for people telling you they're going to do things. Insist that they tell you what they've actually done and how it's going.
Yes, that's interesting. Yes, well, essentially you're saying that, that said letter was aspirational in nature rather than factual. And he, I guess he should have challenged it more. Interesting. Yes,
finally showing that senior manager's regime has got teeth against individuals after several years of various people complaining that no individuals ever seem to get fined at any major firms. Well, this is now a senior individual at a pretty large firm getting a fine that very few people would say was pocket change.
No, indeed. And we can no longer say it's hypothetical that we're still waiting for the first one. We now have the first one after. I mean, that's a very significant issue. I mean, I guess, you know, if you can't enforce under SMCR for something like this, then what can you enforce?
Well, quite.
So in that sense, I think it was a sensible one and a good one to take forward. And I think we now have our precedent to go out and brief boards around the country around what their responsibilities are once more. Thank you. So that was interesting. Yes. There's one other thing from the PRA I thought was interesting. It's more, this should probably go into the more of it. It's not a regulatory development, but it's just an interesting insight into the unintended consequences of regulation. That's the spin I'll put on it. Others might disagree. So the PRA issued a feedback statement on a survey that they ran on bank liquidity. And actually, this was an exercise that was done, although the publication kind of came pretty close to things like Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse and things getting into trouble. But it was unrelated to that. It was actually an exercise that was done a little while before. It just happened to get published. So it's just talking about what stakeholders and banks are saying in a particular area of regulation. And the genesis of this was back in the financial crisis, higher liquidity standards were imposed on banks. There was something called the liquidity coverage ratio. So, you know, banks need to hold this amount of liquid assets, a lot of it high quality liquid assets. So the two act as a cushion in the case of a liquidity stress. The idea being that, you know, that they've got this cushion they can dig into if there's a market stress that they're having to respond to. So essentially the two legs to this regulatory development after financial crisis were hold more liquid assets under this liquidity coverage ratio, and also disclose it. Classic regulatory, raise the standard, increase disclosure. And then the survey came about because central banks, not just in the UK but elsewhere, were noticing that, you know, when stresses were happening, such as COVID, and also just doing the stress test exercises they were doing with banks, banks were incredibly resistant to actually dipping into their LCR. And so the survey was trying to understand why is that? Okay, you know, did the banks not understand what it's there for? It's meant to be this cushion. And the feedback essentially says, the bits that I found most interesting, that because we have to disclose this, if we tell the market that we're now into our liquidity, we're now eating into our liquidity ratio, then the market's going to lose confidence in us, and we're going to be in even more trouble, i.e. we've got this higher standard, but we can't actually use it, because if we do use it, it'll signal weakness to the market, and basically we'll be out of business in no time at all, which is interesting, and I can see why that would be the case, market confidence being such a critical factor for banks. So we appear to have a piece of regulation that has raised standards, but not actually added any usable utility to banks. And anyway, the feedback statement, you know, sorts and talks about some of the things that might be done to try and, you know, minimise its effect to make it a more usable liquidity buffering practice. But I don't remember that well enough, but when these rules were being promulgated back in like 2008, 2009, 2010, that this particular scenario was foreseen It will remains to be seen whether there are tangible rule changes that occur as a result of this feedback statement. But I did find it interesting. So that's my unintended consequences of regulation. musings. So I was thinking we might want to introduce, given the both regulators are getting a new objective to facilitate the achievement of the net zero objective of the Climate Change Act, that we might introduce a sort of a roundup, a sort of a sustainability corner of things the regulators are up to in ESG more broadly. I'm not sure that's a good idea or not, but there were a few things that that they've been up to in the last month or so that, kind of would fit in into that category.
Yes, yeah, there are. I think as its position at the sort of tail end of this podcast might suggest, quite a few people, ourselves probably not entirely excluded, are probably still guilty of thinking of the sort of environmental end of the regulatory agenda as kind of the new bit and the afterthought, and we'll just tag it on. But it is. This stuff's coming out thick and fast enough now, and has been for a while, that I think we all just need to get used to the idea that this is core business as usual for the regulators now. This isn't sort of the new gimmick or anything like that. As you said, David, a few things have come out this month. There have been a couple of speeches. There's been one by David Gill, the director of retail banking at the FCA, particularly focusing on the idea of green mortgages. So these are mortgages which include an incentive for people to either purchase an energy efficient property or improve the energy efficiency of an existing property they might buy, sort of highlighting that lenders risk missing their own decarbonisation targets if they don't increase their support in this sort of area. Talk about how brokers have a key role to play in helping customers navigate an increasingly complex landscape around green mortgages. And also what was particularly interesting was tying this into the Consumer Duty, saying that there are considerations for ESG products centered around suitability. Basically, the more specific a customer is about their requirements, the more specific you need to be in the advice they give them. So if a customer kind of comes to you specifically saying, I want a green mortgage and I want to use it to, I don't know, renovate this old farmhouse and make it work off grid in an energy kind of self-sustaining way, as a broker, you obviously need to be very careful that whatever mortgage advice you give them enables them to do that. It's been another speech by Sarah Breeden, an executive director at the Bank of England, which is sort of reflecting on the collective progress in the transition to net zero. Probably won't be surprised here. The overall view is progress has been made, but we've not yet reached the sort of tipping point where we've built enough of the capability to support the right strategic decisions. Sort of highlights how governments, business, finance, central banks all have unique roles to play to get there. And obviously, the Bank of England is pretty much positioned at the centre of all of those different entities. And finally, the FCA is leading, well, the FCA is currently chairing the coordination group of the Global Financial Innovation Network, which is a group of over 80 international organisations committed to supporting financial innovation in the interests of consumers. And as part of this, the FCA has recently announced it's launching a virtual greenwashing tech sprint. So it's inviting applications to join that tech sprint, which will be held on the 5th of June 2023. All interested UK-based firms are invited to participate. It'll be hosted on the FCA's digital sandbox, and international regulators and firms will also be involved.
Yeah, yes, there's like, you know, trying to position the UK at sort of the forefront of that initiative, which makes sense. Yeah, yes, right. Yeah. I mean, we've talked before about that. You know, that change to the strategic objectives, statutory objectives, I should say, of PIA and FCA to facilitate net zero. That is significant. A line I didn't quote earlier from the PIA business plan, but I'll pick it up now, is it talks about, it says explicitly, this is the year we move from assessing the climate risk to actively supervising against the threats of climate change. So, we've got a mixed bag of initiatives and speeches and events going on, but it's clearly going to become a regular feature of any discussion of UK regulatory developments, and we'll probably be having to spend progressively more time on it. So watch this space on that. Thank you, Ben. Thank you to all our listeners. We will be back next month to give a further update. And by that time, if we've got budget for a bit of music, we might even be able to have a fanfare or two, but I wouldn't necessarily guarantee it. Thank you for your time, and look forward to speaking to you again soon.